This is Davia Nelson of the Kitchen Sisters, and Nikki Silva and I just wrote a book called Hidden Kitchens. It's about secret, underground, below the radar, unexpected, off the grid, unusual community cooking going on all around America. We did this as a series on NPR's Morning Edition, and then took all the stories and listener messages and 30 recipes and 100 photographs and created this book. And we're going to read to you from it now.
This is Nikki. A lot of Kitchen Sisters stories are born in taxicabs. Hidden Kitchens was conceived in the back of a Yellow. Davia lives in San Francisco and hates to drive. She started noticing that every time she got into a Yellow cab, the driver was from Brazil. And not just from Brazil, but from the same town in Brazil, Goiânia. Inevitably, these cab ride conversations turned to music and food. That's when the story of Janete emerged, a woman from their same hometown who comes every day after dark to the abandoned industrial street outside the cab company and sets up a makeshift rolling night kitchen. Hot salgadinhos, bolinhos, pão de queijo. She cooks the food of home. Then by dawn, Janete and her blue tent are packed up and gone.
Certain stories have kitchen sisters written all over them. This sounded like one. One night, around midnight, we decided to go in search of the secret cab yard kitchen. A driver had given us a sketchy map and told us to park in the cab lot and walk to Janete's outpost from there. "Just look like you know where you're going," he said, assuring us no one would notice we didn't work for the company. Seemed pretty obvious to us. Neither of us is from Goiânia, and no other cabbies in sight were wearing headphones and packing 10 pounds of recording equipment. We walked through the fleet of parked cabs, past the graveyard shift mechanic working on a taxi upon the racks, past the checkout point, and out onto a street in the middle of nowhere. There, under a streetlight and a small blue tarp, four drivers were laughing, huddled over big plates of food, eating in Portuguese. Brazilian music spilled out of a parked cab. Janete, shy and smiling, presided. A hidden kitchen vision.
If Janete was making rice and beans on this street at midnight, gathering her community like a campfire, who else was out there, cooking on some other street corner? What other tiny kitchen economies, clandestine cooking, and secret kitchen rituals were waiting to be discovered? We began noticing things. A woman surreptitiously selling tamales out of a baby carriage in downtown Santa Cruz. An after-hours restaurant tucked away in a car wash in L.A. Vietnamese manicurists gathered for a Christmas Eve feast of pho and fish and spring rolls in a neighborhood nail salon in San Francisco. Once we started looking, we found unexpected, improvised, tiny kitchen cultures in places and at times of day we never thought to look before. Our journey began. Hidden kitchens. They were everywhere. We told Ellen McDonald, head of NPR's Morning Edition, about all these little kitchen discoveries and the stories emanating from them, and she was as intrigued as we were. A new series began to emerge.
We opened up the NPR phone line and invited listeners to tell us about their hidden kitchens. The project took on a life of its own. Over the years, we've come to understand the mighty power of the telephone and a voicemail hotline as a way of bringing the public into the storytelling process. People feel comfortable on the phone. It's a natural microphone, intimate, personal, immediate. A good place to tell each other stories and secrets and revelations, where to go and what to do. These phone messages have become a major part of our story-gathering process, a sort of street anthropology involving citizen storytellers, and a way of discovering material we never could have imagined.
Message number 23 was received today at 1:22 p.m. Hello, I'm Margaret Engel from Baltimore, Maryland. A friend of mine who works for Legal Aid was talking to me about what a struggle it is for many of her clients to get food on the table. These are people who don't have an official kitchen and who are using the George Foreman Grill to get a hot meal. Everybody knows the George Foreman Grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is what the grill has meant to immigrants and low-income people. People without a real place to cook. That, to me, is the epitome of a hidden kitchen.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Mertz. I'm a radio producer. The hidden kitchen story I have is about Matthew, a homeless man. Occasionally, he gets to house-sit for an old friend. The last time he was indoors, I gave him a tape recorder so that he could make an audio diary documenting what he likes most about living inside, what he misses most when he's back on the streets. After being indoors for 10 days, he gave me the tape. In 10 days, he made only one entry, the sound of him frying eggs. He said, as a homeless man, he misses nothing more than the sound of home cooking.
Hi, my name is Marty Kapanowski, and I'm from Michigan. I'm calling about a hidden kitchen that I experienced about 15 years ago. I used to work in a luxury car assembly plant for one of the American automakers. One time I missed lunch and the cafeteria was closed. This one guy sort of grabbed me by the arm and pulled me aside and quietly led me down the assembly line. When we got to his toolbox, he opened it up, and inside was a heater, and there were brats cooking and steamed buns right there. He pulled out a brat and put it on a bun, and I bought it from him. And that was my lunch, just hidden right there in the middle, right in front of everyone's eyes, but you couldn't tell it was.
You know, when we opened up the Hidden Kitchens hotline, we asked, we pleaded, please don't tell us about your grandmother and her cooking. We know, it sounds cold, heartless. Kitchens and grandmothers, the two are linked. But that's what we were afraid of. We knew that if we gave grandmother stories an inch, the hotline would melt down. It would be a flood, an endless sea of grandmothers and their cookies, their pies, their advice. Fortunately for us, most of you completely disregarded our plea and called up not once, not twice, but three times to tell us about Grandma. Here are some grandmother stories even the hard-hearted kitchen sisters could not resist.
Big Grandma, Little Grandma. My name is Douglas Weed. I have a story to tell about my two grandma's kitchens. There was only one grandma at a time in my family. They rarely saw each other, didn't particularly like each other. I called them Little Grandma and Big Grandma in an accurate reflection of their physical sizes and the food on their tables. They each lived in small, obscure Pennsylvania towns. Little Grandma ate no seeds, no salt, no sugar, refused to make sauces, would never serve jams, berry pies, berry cobblers, berry pancakes. All meat was boiled or baked. Coarse whole wheat bread was served with salt-free oatmeal for breakfast. Lots of plain boiled vegetables, canned sugar-free fruit for dessert. For a little boy in the 1950s, this was a tough assignment. Any meal at Little Grandma's house was a challenge. The solid, oh-so-plain food, and not much of it. Big Grandma, by contrast, produced dinners to die for. Her table was covered with china serving bowls filled with chicken gravy, gravy-soaked biscuits, another with hot biscuits, two kinds of jam, honey still in the comb, the chicken in its own bowl, and milky coleslaw, a plate of ham, fresh fruit swimming in condensed milk. Big Grandma loved to make decorated two-layer buttercream frosted cakes, yellow, white, chocolate. You could have whatever flavor you wanted. She once made three different cakes for the same day. She baked pies, too, and homemade donuts, fry cakes, she called them. I loved my grandmas. Little Grandma was as sad and troubled as her food was plain. Big Grandma was as happy and as thoughtful as her table was loaded. Both lived into their 80s. Little Grandma died depressed and a bit demented. She lingered. Big Grandma died of high blood pressure and diabetes. A little artery blew up in her head. She fell to the floor dead in mid-sentence. No surprises for either, I suppose. They died as they lived, as they cooked in their nearly identical kitchens.
The Hidden Kitchens book is full of these phone messages, but it's also full of stories, too, stories that we sort of, take many pages to unfold. One of our favorites comes from another phone message. We'll read you the message, but trust us, the story of, it says, "Hey, my name is John T. Edge, and I live down in Oxford, Mississippi. I'm calling about a woman you all need to know about. Her name is Georgia Gilmore. She was a cook in the 1950s in Montgomery, Alabama. And when I think of Hidden Kitchens, I think about the story of her backdoor restaurant, her secret kitchen that fueled the civil rights movement. And Georgia Gilmore lost her job at a lunch counter when she supported Rosa Parks in the Montgomery bus boycott. And Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a young minister in town, loved Georgia Gilmore's cooking, and he helped stake her to a secret restaurant in her house where blacks and whites could eat together, where some of the best fried chicken on the planet was fried, and where this woman, Georgia Gilmore, who was 350 pounds and Dr. Martin Luther King called her tiny, created also the Club from Nowhere, a group of women who cooked pies and cakes and sold them in beauty parlors and at taxi stands to help support the Montgomery bus boycott. So the book has these long stories and these short messages, but today we're just sharing some of the messages with you. The last chapter in the book is called The Fellowship of Food.
If there is a single unifying theme to the hours of stories and messages we've gathered, that theme is not about food, but about fellowship. It is really this that lay beneath most of the stories, the hidden thing that happens in the best of kitchens. Something is shared. It happens between two people, late at night, and in small towns among neighbors. It happens in large communities among friends and among strangers. The secret ingredients are important, and the way it all tastes, but most important is what the food evokes, a memory, a bond, a good story.
My name is Tia Lati. My hidden kitchen story is this. When I was a little girl, my family lived fairly far out on Long Island. One day I was playing, and I heard a bell ring and saw a man coming down pushing a two-wheel cart, a little two-wheeled cart. I thought maybe he was the ice cream man, so I ran down to greet him and said, "Do you have ice cream?" He said, "No, little girl, I am selling fish." I said, "Fish? No ice cream?" He said, "Well, no, but you can have one of these if you want." And he shucked a cherry stone clam and said, "You want to try it?" And I said, "Sure." And I liked it, and I swallowed it down. And he said, "Here, have another." And he gave me as many as I wanted to eat. Once a week, he would come by, and I would run down to greet him, and he'd shuck cherry stone clams as long as I ate them. I'm sorry to say there are probably no more fishmen pushing little carts through villages on Long Island anymore. 2,879 minutes of messages came into our Hidden Kitchens hotline, so we just, you know, got to share the abundance with you.
Message number 721 was received Saturday at 10:35 a.m. My name is Judy Davis. I'm calling about Aunt Ethel. My Aunt Ethel's knishes were famous, not just in the family, not just in the Jewish play school where she was the lunch lady, and not just in Levittown, Pennsylvania, where she and Uncle Irv lived for 40 years. Ethel's knishes were known across the country. She didn't market them, and she didn't put her recipe on the internet. She just shared them. She shared them with whomever they got to know at whatever campsite, at whatever national forest they happened to be vacationing in at the time. In the early years, she and Uncle Irv camped in a trailer with a pop-up tent. By the time of their retirement, it was a prized motorhome. But whatever the vehicle, it always contained a freezer stuffed with knishes. It was an annual treat hearing Irv tell about how Ethel fed knishes to camping neighbors who'd never met a Jew in their lives, much less tasted such a delicacy. Knowing Ethel's gregariousness, her won't-take-no-for-an-answer style, and the incredible flakiness of those savory potato-stuffed morsels, it was not surprising to hear how often such strangers became fast friends, meeting regularly at one site or another for decades.
Ethel was a maverick in her immigrants' family's world. Over the years, she endured much criticism and ridicule from her sisters and brothers-in-law in order to follow her American-born playboy of a husband. Unlike any of her sisters, she knew how to have fun. She knew how to play cards, take trips. My God, she even knew how to enjoy the outdoors. For all the rest of the family, the outdoors was dangerous. Driving on a highway any place you didn't have to go was crazy. Swimming in a cold pond with live fish was unthinkable. Most of all, exposing your daughter to a world outside the Jewish neighborhood was downright playing with fire. Ethel could be kosher and a camper. She could share her husband's love for adventure, and she could make him stop at every kosher butcher and synagogue along the way. She could schlep the two sets of pots and pans, one for dairy and one for meat, from campsite to campsite, and she could make friends with strangers. It was those strangers turned friends, northerners and southerners, blacks and whites, Jews and Gentiles, who were there at her funeral. They were there with their love for Ethel and their wonderful stories about how much fun they had had together and how much they were going to miss those knishes by the campfire. Okay, we're now jumping to the last piece. It's called The Complicated Heart of the Nation. It's how we close Hidden Kitchens.
Over the time we've spent gathering these Hidden Kitchen stories, our microphone has become a kind of stethoscope, listening to the complicated heart of the nation. In the plazas of San Antonio, the racing pits of NASCAR, the rising lakes of the Ojibwe, over the hard road of hunger that led George Foreman to boxing, we have been baptized in dip, shown secret recipes that have been passed down from father to son, and witnessed micro-rivalries across the country over sauce and grilling techniques. We've come to wonder, how can there ever be peace in the world when we can't even agree on how to barbecue? Yet in some ways, this is our only hope, that we can disagree about barbecue and still stay connected. More than ever, America is portrayed as a nation divided by race, politics, economics, war. But our tape recorder and answering machine are picking up another part of the story. All over the country, there are people who are concerned about embracing and creating traditions that bring about understanding and appreciation in their families, neighborhoods, and the world.
Perhaps these small kitchen stories are not just stories, but a kind of guide, a way to travel through daily life, with eyes open to the hand-painted signs on the side of the road, to thinking about where the money we spend for food is going, to spotting a pit being fired up in a churchyard and the picnic that will soon follow, to farmers' markets, to community kitchens, to taking in all of these scents and stories as they mingle and merge into one bigger American story. America Eats, they called it back in the 1930s. We named it Hidden Kitchens in 2004. If we are lucky, 50 years from now, some other nationwide collaboration will come along and stare into the fire pits and soup kettles of the nation and ask some of these same questions. Who glues your community together through food? Who is cooking on your corner? What traditions are vanishing from your neighborhood, your family, the planet? They will stop and ask these questions. This part always makes me cry. Okay, I'm going to gather myself. They will stop and ask these questions, and if they are as lucky as we are, they will get invited to eat, to sit at the table, and hear a story, and learn a recipe. It's the food, but more than that, it's the fellowship, this improvisational, ingenious, imaginative cooking, new and old, a spirit that can't be suppressed, alive across America. Food is our universal language. It's what we have in common. When in doubt, cook. To subscribe to The Writer's Block and hear more stories, visit www.kqed.org/writersblock.